With the money I received from Aunt Anna and Sal, I opened 15 accounts under different names at the New York Dime Savings and Loan, where the president, Mr. Sherwood, was known to be friendly to bootleggers. One large deposit would have attracted the attention of the feds. Mr. Sherwood was sitting in his office, a banjo hanging on the wall. I slipped him $1,000, since a little grease never hurts. On my way out, I asked him, "You play the blues?" "It depends on the green." We shook hands and I left. The next day, I took the high school equivalency exam, which I easily passed, and enrolled in the new American dream, success through education. Before the fall semester at City College began, I made a quick trip to Carmel. Crossing the road, I took a circuitous path to the porch door, which I silently opened and closed, making sure that the spring didn't snap. I wanted my homecoming to be a surprise. A card game was in progress. I could hear Jimmy repeating his name and insisting that the next game be played for a penny a point. Vasily, the new hired hand, was grumbling about bad cards, while Mr. Schneiderman, as always, kibitzed, and my mother called for the cards to be cut. As I stood there listening, I gathered that shy, timid Celia had become quite a pinochle shark. Another voice came from the porch. Ben's. Slipping into the house, I saw that little had changed. The room once occupied by the prof and the princess now held a small stove and shelves stocked with dishes. The new boarders had complained that Mom's cooking wasn't kosher enough. I guess when it comes to orthodoxy, no extreme is too great. Mom's room looked the same, except for a framed photograph on her dresser of Mr. Schneiderman, placed next to a wooden box holding the letters I'd written from New York. My old room, adjacent to Mom's, now belonged to Mr. Schneiderman, and his to Vasily. When Mom saw me, her joyful Yiddish expressions were followed by copious tears. That evening, what had been planned as a modest meal turned into a feast. I noticed that Mom's once delicate hands were calloused and sunburned, and that she now seemed content kneading bread. As in the past, we talked best in the kitchen, where she disclosed that she and Mr. Schneiderman were a team. He would use hand gestures to indicate the cards that others were holding. From New York to Carmel, everyone was seeking an edge. The only difference between Mom and the others was the size of the stakes. The principle remained exactly the same. I couldn't help laughing. America had come to Carmel. For my part, I gave her a sanitized version of my adventures, omitting Cape May. What was the point? If I said I'd seen Aunt Anna, Mom would have asked about Uncle Sam, since I was always threatening to settle scores with him. Besides, I planned to give Mom the money that I'd taken from the safe. If I told her it had come from my aunt, she would have been on the phone in a minute, thanking her for her wonderful gift. So I said nothing. Once the table was cleared, the accordion music and piano playing began, accompanied by singing and clapping. I danced with all the friends Mom had invited until all my elderly partners had quit from exhaustion, leaving just Ben and me. We talked until dawn, sitting in the kitchen enjoying tea in each other's company. The old affection was still there as we reminisced about hayrides and horseshoes, Carmel and Claire, who'd written to say that she was now in Chicago and planned to join an anarchist group active in Cambridge. The prof and the princess, according to a news article about Marjorie the medium, had apparently settled in Boston. Perhaps the princess and Claire would one day join forces. Slowly, the discussion focused on me. What had I been doing? Did I like the city more than the country? Ben had applied to the Woodbine Agricultural School and been admitted. Would I someday be returning to school? I answered all his questions, telling him everything. Ben listened in awe. I could see from his expression that my travels in the underworld both delighted and shocked him. Outlaws and gangsters were the stuff of dime novels. He marveled at my living such a life. But as I unraveled my tale, I knew that I didn't want to spend the rest of my life worrying about crops. I was living proof of the song, "How you gonna keep 'em down on the farm after they've seen Paris?" Under no circumstances was I gonna trade concerts for calves and Harlem for heifers. "You could go to college in Philadelphia. It's closer." "Ben, I know you want me to eventually rejoin you in Carmel, and though I love you dearly, my home is now in New York City. I'm still the same Ben, but I'm not the same Henny." We talked for hours. I omitted nothing, not even the rape. He begged me to stay. Trying to ease my way out, I said, "Who knows what will happen in the future? We'll just have to see. There are things between us that neither of us can ever forget. Don't be hasty, Henny. Think about it. Go to the city and once in a while remember fireflies on summer nights. If you change your mind, I'll be waiting." Somewhere in a secret chamber of his heart, Ben believed in a Henrietta who would always be there for him. I heard people stirring. It was morning. Before the screen door swung open and Ben walked out of my life, I kissed him, and we both cried. Aunt Anna's nephew had pulled strings and arranged a probationary admission for me to City College. The campus was prettier than I expected, particularly the Gothic buildings. My first day, I asked some students how to find Professor Stefan Stein's classroom. At the bell, I took a seat. He was lecturing on Captain John Smith's idyllic 17th century account of America, written to entice fellow Englishmen to set sail for the New World. "If a man work but 3 days and seven," quoting Smith, "he may get more than he can spend unless he be excessive." In all these years, apparently nothing had changed. The way to move men was to appeal to their greed. "For our pleasure here," Smith had rhapsodized, "is still games." All the people I knew, mugs and mention alike, would have thrilled to Smith's hymn, but especially Rodman. Like the good captain, Hank believed in the future because its essence was dream, the dream of a fuller, richer life. All you had to do was screw on your fists and range daily, as Smith said, into those unknown parts to hunt and to hawk. For the poor fishers, unskilled with a net, there was, and still is, another conveyance for making a catch. An angle. The lure of quick riches brought millions to these shores and ruined thousands. But it was neither recklessness nor rapacity that led Hank to his death. He was victimized by his past, by the poor beginnings and hard necessities that made him dream of easy money and a woman's soft embraces. But just as John Smith's paradise had been torn up to make way for city blocks and farm fields, Rodman's had been trampled underfoot by Brad's bovine stupidity and ancestral privileges. Without old wealth and family ties, Hank was outclassed. On that last afternoon, as he floated on his mattress, alone with his memories, he must have known how dearly he paid for dreaming that he and Lily could go home again, to build a life on a bootlegger's bankroll. Although Hank's melodies failed to make his lady fair leave her castle gloom, he sang a haunting tune that briefly set her dancing, as in times gone by. In telling this story, I too have sung a song, a paean to the people and the passions of those former days. In reviving the night music of lockpicking and smuggling, of diamonds and dancing, I've resided in the house of the past, recording what I remember is true. And yet memory deceives, feelings intrude, words distort. If the chroniclers are right that history is always a farrago of fancy and fact, I hope to be forgiven for making felonies fun and sordidness saucy. I see now that a book, like a life, is a pastiche of plagiarisms. To write mine, I have borrowed and bent. Even Rodman and Pop mostly copied. Hank modeled himself after the swells in their top hats and spats. Pop followed in the footsteps of those who said they left Poland for paradise. Both fancied America the Golden Medina, a hope long since sterile, but once fecund as the rivers Captain Smith fished. Somnambulists of a vanished dream, they would surely feel, were they to pass through the garbage-strewn streets of this country, through the hungry and tortured cries of the night, that they'd wakened on a fallen world. Or would they? Perhaps, despite the omens drear, the land cold from the quickening of greed, they would still hear the varied carols of America singing.